You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin lost almost 4,000 manufacturing jobs in 2016, lagging behind the national trend. At the same time, thousands of job openings still exist in the production sector. We'll talk to an economist about how manufacturing is looking for job seekers.
First, President Trump recently announced that he will pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Accords, which were reached late last year. That would put the U.S. in the company of only two other countries who did not sign the accords, Syria and Nicaragua.
And administration officials have been unclear on the White House policy toward climate change, with mixed messages about whether climate change is happening and whether it's caused by humans. Meanwhile, public opinion is accepting the scientific consensus on climate change, with recent surveys showing that more and more Americans are concerned about the issue and want action.
Barry Rabe is a non-resident senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and is a professor in the University of Michigan's Ford School of Public Policy. He's written numerous articles about climate change, public opinion, and governmental response. Barry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me, Judith.
So you said in a recent article that the Trump administration's stance on climate change is hard to pin down. Why?
It has been interesting. This has been a very eventful month for climate change policy in the U.S., as you noted in the introduction. But we still don't have a real clear sense what the president's views on this are. In fact, during that rather lengthy event at the Rose Garden where he decided to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Agreement, he really didn't say one way or the other whether he thought climate change was occurring or if it was a significant problem. He did at the very end of his remarks say he would be willing to start afresh and negotiate something new, but we haven't had any more detail on that. And so it's interesting that we don't really have a clear sense on this. Some members of his administration have really been challenged by reporters to go on record, but the president really has not said any more on the issue since that event.
And what do we know about where public opinion stands today on whether climate change is real?
Well, this has been an issue where there are divides for some time. But we've just completed a survey. In fact, we were in the field and completed our survey, a national telephone survey across the U.S. These were folks who were being asked this question before it was known what the president was going to do about Paris. And this is something that we've been doing twice a year for almost 10 years now. And we found that 70% of Americans believe there is solid evidence that global temperatures have been warming, that there is global warming. And that's actually up from recent years. What we've seen is a jump up from the kind of the low 60% level to now in our last few surveys around 70%. That means that the remainder are either thinking that there isn't solid evidence of this or are not sure. But it means that overwhelmingly, by margins of more than 3-1, that Americans do believe that this is occurring.
So more Americans believe it's occurring. How concerned do they seem to be about that?
Well, and here we're finding that people are becoming somewhat more concerned over time and are also really locking into their positions much more. And so when you ask not only, gee, how do you feel, yes, no, on that particular question, we then follow up by asking, how confident are you that you're right in saying that warming is or is not occurring? We're finding on both sides of this that people are more and more confident all the time that their position is right. Vast majority saying that there is warming occurring and really strong confidence in this. So there's no evidence that this is the issue that is of greatest concern for most Americans by any stretch of the imagination. But the numbers have continued to pop up in the last several years on this and really are peaking in this last survey.
And what do we see as far as breakdown of who's believing and not? Are there differences that are noticeable between, say, political parties or age groups or parts of the country?
The biggest divide on this continues to be partisanship. That's not always been the case, but in recent years, the differences are really quite significant when you're talking to self-identified Democrats versus independents or Republicans. Now, for each of those categories, the numbers of those who say that they see solid evidence of global warming continues to nudge up, but the Democrats considerably higher than Republicans, and actually independents now pretty close to Democrats, but a little bit below in that measure. The other part of this, though, is where we begin to look at what people want governments to do about this, policy issues and the like. And there we continue to see some partisan divides, but even also some convergence on some questions.
So what does the American public want the federal government to do? Do they want the government to be engaged in addressing climate change?
Well, this is also a question that we've been asking for some time. And there had, around 2012, 2013, there was a drop in the percentage of Americans who would answer a question about, you know, is it your state's responsibility to address global warming in the absence of federal action? That was dropping down probably about 48-50% a couple of years ago. But now in this latest survey, again, April and May of this year, but before the public knew what President Trump was going to do with regard to Paris, we're seeing 66% of Americans who say that it is their state's responsibility to address the issue of global warming. That's the highest number on that front that we have seen in some time.
And that's really particularly interesting, I think, that given that after President Trump said that he wants to pull out of the Paris Accords, some states, some cities, even some corporations have pledged to work on meeting the goals regardless of what position the federal government takes or what level the federal government takes in participating. Does that make you think that those municipalities and states and corporations will get support from their residents or from their customers?
Well, this becomes a great, great political and policy question going forward. You're quite right that we have seen a tremendous amount of response from governors and mayors since the Paris announcement, although thus far, those are leaders whose jurisdictions have already, for the most part, been doing something pretty active in the area of reducing their emissions, often linked to energy transition. And clearly, one of the factors that have helped reduce American emissions fairly substantially, actually, over the last 10 years, about 8 or 9 percentage points down from where they were in 2005, even though we have more people and a larger economy, there are a series of factors there. But when you add up all the things that individual states and localities have done, that has been significant in many respects. This then becomes a really, really interesting test of Wisconsin and other states, including large cities, not so large cities, what they do and how they respond, especially now after Paris, when there's clearly not going to be pressure from the current federal government to mandate or require states or industries to make major shifts to reduce their emissions. That really does become a state-by-state, industry-by-industry kind of a decision. And really, the power that was there earlier in the last decade is clearly in the hands of the states in deciding what they are going to do or not do.
We're talking with Barry Rabe. He's a professor of public policy at the University of Michigan, talking about public opinion and climate change. The Trump administration seems to be committed to more traditional forms of energy production, moving ahead with pipeline approvals and calling for investment in the coal sector, for example. What does the data say about how the public views a greener energy economy?
We were really quite struck to see on issues of renewable energy or energy efficiency, these are issues that have very, very strong public support at about the 75-85% level across a range of policy options. In other words, if you ask people, should their state be mandating increases in renewables, requiring increases in energy efficiency, there's tremendous buy-in, three-quarters or more from Americans that their state should be doing this. And actually, this is an area where the numbers are quite high, regardless of whether you're talking to a Democrat, an independent, or a Republican, as well as more generally support for wind and solar, in many cases amongst people who don't think that there's evidence of global warming, but think it's something that their state should do for a number of reasons, possibly related to the economy and job-related sorts of activity. So this really does seem to be have a broad buy-in. And actually now there are more than half the states that have some version and variation of these policies. And it's not necessarily just the ones that we associate with being kind of leaders or most vocal on climate change. It includes states like Texas and North Dakota, which are seeing huge increases in the amount of energy they're getting from wind and other renewable sources, along with, as you're suggesting, oil and gas from fracking operations.
And Barry, as we wrap up, so we have public opinion shifting in a pretty significant way towards actively addressing climate change. But as we've said, we currently have an administration that is reversing policies and priorities in that area. What do you think comes next?
I think the near-term test is what states who realize that policy and power shifts back to them, what they actually do about it. So that it is indeed one thing to take a bold step and say, we're going to fly to Beijing and meet with the Premier of China, as Governor Brown did from California. It's another thing to sign a petition. And yet it's a much bigger challenge than to actually develop and adopt a policy to go through your legislature to build the kind of coalitions that you need to do some of the things that the public seems to want. Those are tests and challenges for states which, already have large agendas, have their own partisan divides, whether, again, that's Wisconsin or other parts of the country. So I think the real test of this, certainly over the next year or so, is what states do with this. And do, in fact, we begin to see not just states or regions working more with other countries like China, but also other neighbors like Canada and Mexico, where we have a tremendous cross-border amount of economic activity and energy movement north-south. We're already seeing a number of both states and certainly provinces in Canada and Mexican states beginning to talk about working more collaboratively, because they're all federal systems, rather than relying so much on national and federal governments, at a point where relations between the federal government and the U.S. and both Mexico and Canada are pretty strained, certainly on energy and climate issues, but also trade and the NAFTA accords. Do we begin to see a more kind of decentralized political leadership on this issue?
Barry, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Judith.
Barry Rabe is a non-resident senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and is a professor in the University of Michigan's Ford School of Public Policy. He shared recent data on trends in public opinion on the topic of climate change.
Manufacturing has long been a key part of Wisconsin's economy, but like most of the U.S., it's seen a steady decline over time. New numbers show the state lost thousands of production sector jobs last year, factoring into a relatively slow pace in overall job growth.
At the same time, there are thousands of job openings in manufacturing, and some employers say they're having trouble finding workers to fill positions. It's something Governor Walker has pointed to in saying that a skills gap rather than job creation is the major issue facing the state's economy.
Noah Williams is with us in the studio now to talk about where things stand with the manufacturing job market. He's a professor of economics at UW-Madison and director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy. Noah, welcome back to the show.
Great. Happy to be here.
So these numbers last year, it looks like a decline in manufacturing jobs in Wisconsin. What do those numbers look like? How do we compare to the rest of the country?
So this was the gold standard figures, which came out. It's called the Quarterly Census of Employment and Wages. And if we compare year over year, December 2016 through December 2015, we're looking at a loss of about 3,700 jobs in the state. On a percentage basis, that's a little bit less than 1% of manufacturing employment, which was lost in the state. Compared to nationwide, we saw manufacturing employment roughly constant over the same span. But if we look more at our neighbors in Minnesota, Illinois, and Iowa, those states all experienced declines of roughly comparable magnitudes as well.
And what's driving those declines? Is it a matter of we're producing less stuff, so there are fewer jobs, or is it a matter of we're producing stuff with more mechanization, with more robotic technology and things like that?
Well, so this is part of a long-term pattern of a decline in both the percentage of the labor force employed in manufacturing and particularly since 2000 in the overall number of people employed in manufacturing. So yes, production and output has continued to go up, but we have been producing more with less.
How much, I should say, how important is manufacturing for the Wisconsin economy?
Manufacturing is the largest single sector in the economy. It accounts for roughly 18% of private employment, so on the order of 470,000 jobs. And it accounts for even more than that in terms of output, roughly 19% of all output in the state. So it's a has historically been an important sector and continues to be so today.
Now, Governor Walker had signed the Manufacturing and Agricultural Tax Credit soon after he took office back in 2011, fully phased in finally last year. It really cut the effective rate of corporate taxes for manufacturers from just shy of 8% to less than 0.5% now. What, and you've studied this, what effect do you see that having on manufacturing in the state?
Yeah, so this was one of the things I'd wanted to look at because it has been in the news, and particularly with the most recent budget cycle, it came up again as a discussion topic. And I found that it had very significant employment impact in the state. In particular, I can go into the details of how I did the study, but my baseline estimate was that cumulatively, since the tax has been phased in, it could account for roughly 20,000, an increase in roughly 20,000 manufacturing jobs in the state. And in addition, a spillover to broader employment. So with each manufacturing job, there will be other jobs created in other parts of the state economy, and I found roughly one for one.
And to get into a little more detail, and we've seen this 2011, we were just starting to come up from the bottom after the Great Recession. Yes. We've seen, 80-some months now of consecutive job growth nationwide. How do you tease out the impact of this tax credit from just this overall national trend?
Yeah, so what I did, because it is so difficult to distinguish policy impacts, and in particular, even just comparing against our border states, there's vast differences, say, between Wisconsin and Minnesota in terms of industry makeup, urban concentration, things like that, that I really wanted to focus on a localized comparison to make things cleaner. So what I did was look at the experience of the border counties in Wisconsin and those counties across the border in Illinois, Minnesota, some in the Upper Peninsula, and a few in Iowa. And so what I did was look at the differential employment responses since the tax credit was phased in 2013 in those counties. And what I found was even on the border counties, there was very rapid change and very significant differences between what happened in Wisconsin versus counties just across the border. And they seem to be highly responsive to differentials in tax rates.
Talking to Noah Williams, economist at UW-Madison, director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy, looking at manufacturing jobs here in Wisconsin. Noah, we mentioned earlier the skills gap. Governor Walker has focused on that. He's not the only one. How much of a, I guess, drag on the manufacturing industry is a lack of workers who are ready for the manufacturing jobs of today, which are often more highly trained, sometimes high tech jobs?
Yes. No, I think that's very important. If we look at the job center for Wisconsin, we see on the order of 10,000 job openings in the manufacturing sector. So even though we have shed some jobs recently, there's still a vast number of jobs which are going unfilled. And this is largely the case that manufacturers are having a hard time finding people who are qualified and willing to work. The WMC recently did a survey of their members, and they found 77% had reported difficulty in finding available workers, and they rated this as their number one concern.
And some people have been critical of the idea of a skills gap, saying, well, if you've got demand for workers that isn't being filled, you should pay more and offer to do more of the training you need. Is that part of the solution?
So certainly training, I think, is an important part of it. And we have seen an increase, as the governor and the president, we're talking about the apprenticeship programs, sure. And we've seen a big expansion of that in the state. Certainly, we would all like to see wages go up, but the difficulty is in a competitive national and global economy. Most employers in Wisconsin simply don't have a whole lot of control over what they can pay. So they have to take market wages essentially as given, and some of the jobs are only would only be profitable to be filled at particular wages.
You mentioned the governor and the president talking about possible solutions. What kind of things from a state policy perspective would make sure that our Wisconsin workforce has more people ready to fill these jobs?
Yeah, so certainly there's probably a broader array of things which could be done at the national level, but certainly within the state, continued education and training. I think the manufacturing and agriculture tax credit has been important, but equally important for many businesses looking to invest in the state are other taxes. We remain a high tax state, so even though the governor has held the line on property taxes remain relatively high, income taxes remain relatively high. But again, one thing which seems to be holding us back is the supply of available workers. So anything we can do to encourage more people, more mobility, and more people to move to the state would be very beneficial.
As we wrap up, as you watch the manufacturing sector in Wisconsin, what are the next signs you're looking for, the next tea leaves you want to read?
Well, so what we have seen, the QCEW numbers, which we're talking about, are a little bit of a backward-looking indicator.
Right.
They are the most comprehensive. But if we look at the surveys which have been done since then, put out by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we actually have seen an uptick coming in the end of 2016 into 2017. So employment in the sector does look like it has rebounded from perhaps a temporary lull. So things do seem to be on the uptick. Certainly, I expect the labor market to continue to tighten. Certainly, as this happens nationwide, we would expect an uptick in wages to be a result of that as well.
We'll leave it there for now. Noah, thanks a lot for coming up today.
Great. Thank you.
That's Noah Williams. He joined us in our studio to break down the state of Wisconsin's manufacturing job market. He's a professor of economics at UW-Madison.
A Minnesota jury last week acquitted a police officer in the shooting death of Philando Castile. Castile's death sparked protests in Minnesota and elsewhere, especially as video of the shooting was broadcast by Castile's girlfriend as she sat next to him as he died.
The acquittal of police officer Geronimo Yanez came as a surprise to some, given the video evidence of the incident, and could potentially further the divide between law enforcement and minority communities.
Kemi Chavis joins us now. She's a professor of law and director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University School of Law. She's a former prosecutor as well. Kemi, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So what was your reaction when you heard about the acquittal?
Well, when I heard about the acquittal of Officer Yanez, I was surprised because we all saw, millions of Americans saw the live Facebook streaming that Diamond Reynolds did during the shooting. And to me, it was very egregious. You know, I thought, this is really egregious. He's telling you that he has a weapon, like he's licensed to carry this weapon. And he really, Philando Castile, the victim here, really did everything he was supposed to do. And the fact that Diamond Reynolds and her young daughter were also in the car and were endangered by this officer's behavior was very troubling as well. So I say that I'm surprised in that sense, but in some ways, I'm not, because we know that these cases are very difficult.
And friends and family of Philando Castile were distraught over the news of the acquittal. Here's his mother speaking after the ruling came down.
My son loved this city, and this city killed my son, and the murderer gets away. Are you kidding me right now?
So, Kemi, of course, every case is different, but how do communities in general cope with cases like this when there is an acquittal of the police officer?
Yeah, you know, this is, it's very troubling, and many communities, unfortunately, have dealt with this historically. You know, we have, over the last maybe 4 or 5 years, been more attuned to some of the things that that are happening because of social media and cell phones. We are, as the general public, we are more likely to see these cases and recognize them, but realize that a lot of this has been happening. I think what's really troubling for communities is we're saying, well, we have, now we have body camera footage, cell phone footage, we have these things, and it's still very difficult for officers in this case. And again, not every case will be deemed an unjustified shooting. There are times when officers, when you're giving the facts surrounding the case, reasonably, act reasonably. I just think that many times communities are seeing that often there's nothing else, again, that Mr. Castile could have done to allay the officers' fears, and he's lost his life because of that.
And as we heard, Valerie Castile feels that her son was murdered, and Geronimo Yanez, the officer, was charged with manslaughter in the shooting, not murder. Why would a choice be made to go for manslaughter in a case like this?
Yes, well, when we're thinking about the criminal law and there are different types of homicides, murder being the most serious type of homicide. But manslaughter, again, very serious charge, and I don't have the Minnesota, the statute in front of me, but when we're thinking about manslaughter, it could be based on some type of recklessness or negligence rather than, an intent to kill or a depraved indifference, which usually would be a higher, more serious charged with murder. And so I have to say, we've gone different increments when thinking about these arguments. First, the argument is, well, these officers aren't charged at all. And I think, because of the attention a lot of these cases are getting, we're starting to see officers charged, but we can kind of tick through, five or six cases where officers recent cases where officers have been charged, their cases have been, they've gone to trial, and they've been acquitted, or the jury has deadlocked. As you may recall, in the Walter Scott case, which was another case caught on videotape, very egregious shooting. The suspect is seen running away, and the jury could not come to a decision in that case. So bringing the charges is one thing, but really being able to secure a conviction is quite another.
And of course, it's difficult not being in the jury room as they deliberate. But what do you think might have led the jury in this case to acquit Officer Yanez in the killing of Philando Castile?
Yes, I'm glad that you said that, because we, as disappointed as I am, and as I think as many others are in this verdict, we were not in that room. And again, they're weighing the evidence. They're seeing far. A lot of us saw that the Facebook post, but again, they were privy to all types of testimony. I would not want to speculate as to what they were thinking, but one thing that we know in these cases is that if the officer was in reasonable fear for the officer's safety or life, then that carries a lot of weight in terms of whether or not that officer was justified in using force. And the hard truth of that is that it is very easy and often it could be true, but many times, if an officer tells a jury, I was afraid for my life, in my mind, this is what was going on. This was a rapidly unfolding situation. And so my concern is that this case sends two troubling messages. And one message is that, police officers, it's very easy to say that, even though that may not have been the case, or that may not, or it should not have been the case. That's one message it sends for officers. Okay, we say that, and then we're not going to be held accountable. And another message that it sends is to the community that quite frankly, these lives don't matter.
We're talking with Cami Chavis right now. She's a professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University School of Law. She's with us to talk about the recent acquittal of the officer in the Philando Castile shooting, law enforcement, and what can be done to mend relations between police departments and minority communities.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1110. 1, 2, 3, 4. What was your reaction to that acquittal this weekend? More generally, what do you think law enforcement should do to prevent these kind of shootings? What can communities and police departments do to maybe allay some of the tension, some of the perceived mutual threats they see in each other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about the acquittal of the police officer who shot and killed Philando Castile last year during a traffic stop. We're talking to Cami Chavis. She's a professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University School of Law.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the ruling in this case, the acquittal of the police officer in the case? What do you think law enforcement should do to try to avoid these situations? What can be done to build better connections between minority communities in particular and police departments? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So, Cami, on the heels of the ruling in the Philando Castile case this weekend, a young pregnant mother in Seattle named Charlena Lyles was shot and killed by police when she called to report a burglary. What do we know about what happened there?
So my understanding is that officers had been to Mrs. Lyles' home before on other calls. And she had at one point wielded scissors or something like that. And then they're called back to the home, because she is reporting a burglary. So she is, you know, saying that she is the victim of a crime. And from what I understand, at least what the officers are saying. And again, what's important is that we only have really the officers' accounts here and what can be heard on the audio that's been made available. But once they were in the home, they were kind of saying that these are the things that look like they're missing. And then the officers reported that, you know, she was holding a knife. Now, my understanding is that two officers, typically when a citizen has made a call like this, you'll send one officer out because of those previous calls to her home and what officers had experienced previously. Two officers were sent to the home. But again, this is a case that makes me, there are a few things that I think about when looking at this case, because Ms. Lyles, according to her father, I think was 90 pounds. There were at least 3 to 4 other children in the house, and there are two officers there. And so, and neither of them, I believe, I'm not sure, but at least one of the officers is saying he didn't have a taser. Mm-hmm. So he didn't have, even if the officers were threatened, physically threatened in that case, they didn't have, according to them, less than lethal alternatives. And I do believe that as we begin to think about solutions to this, that we really need to think about less than lethal alternatives, particularly in the case here where there's some suggestion that she may have had some mental health issues.
My understanding is that on the audio, one officer says, tase her, and the other one says, I don't have a taser, and that, in fact, the Seattle police offer as non-lethal tools to officers the choice of a taser, a billy club, or pepper spray. So why do you think non-lethal weapons, non-lethal tools are not used more often in order to subdue people?
Well, when from the viewpoint of a law enforcement officer, so what I have heard many law enforcement officers say is that, well, if you are, and of course, and this is true from a legal standard, if you are threatened with deadly force, then an appropriate response can be deadly force. I think that a lot of times in these cases, you know, again, we think about, okay, this is a, if these were not two police officers and this was, you know, a 90-pound woman with a knife and two other individuals that were standing there, you know, would the use of a gun have been considered excessive force, right, if they were trying to, you know, defend themselves? So I'm kind of thinking about it from that standpoint. But officers, you know, you are allowed to respond with deadly force if you are facing deadly force. The issue, and that's from a legal standard, but I think as we again kind of explore solutions, there have been many instances we need to think about. Well, why are officers often very quick and sometimes can make mistakes, right? With respect to, okay, you've asked me for my driver's license, I'm going to pull it out of my pocket, but now all of a sudden you think that I'm going for a weapon. I mean, so there we really need to think about the use of first of all, non-lethal uses of force, like what you mentioned, tasers, billy clubs, pepper spray, are some issues that are still very dangerous and can harm people, but can also save lives and protect officers. And then we need to think about de-escalating. How does a woman end up dead because she called officers for help? And there's been several other cases, the last case in Oklahoma, that officer was also acquitted, where, the motorist is stranded in the middle of the highway, and immediately, instead of thinking this might be a person who needs help, this is a person who is a threat.
Let's go to our phones, and Quincy in Melrose is up first. Hi, Quincy.
How are you?
Good.
I guess, well, a lot of it, we used to call it, it's kind of like almost being in a circular firing squad. We get images of we African American people being violent, and it's portrayed over and over and over. And my personal idea or belief is, as soon as the person identified, I have a gun, everything else ceased, and he felt he was threatened. And then you get the bad result. And I've lived through the 60s all the way up to today. So I've seen this over and over. It's a pattern. It's pervasive. And a lot of it has to do with what are the images that we're seeing. And if we keep showing people as criminals, thugs, all this is what they're going to think we are.
All right, Quincy, I want to give Cammie a chance to respond there. So Quincy's saying we don't know each other and we get these images of other communities and we don't have a hope of really connecting.
Yeah, well, I think what Quincy has touched on is really this very serious issue of implicit racial bias. And this is something that, research around, but, I'm not sure that this issue of implicit racial bias came up that it has come up in many of the cases that we've seen, but certainly in the Philando Castile case, he's legally licensed to carry a weapon. Officers are trained on how to deal with suspects who may be carrying. So, the response is not to open fire on that person, particularly when you have two very innocent bystanders, right or in very close proximity. So this issue of implicit racial bias, it is real. And I say implicit, I mean, we talk a lot about implicit racial bias. That's not to say that explicit racial bias doesn't come into play. But we know that the black male stereotypes or stereotypes of people of color and particularly black males are really rampant in our media, just like your caller mentioned. And it can have a very negative effect.
Quincy, thanks for that call. And we'll go next to Zaland in Green Bay. Zaland, thanks for calling.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. I had a general comment. My brother-in-law's from Afghanistan, and he was a police officer there. And when he came here recently, we talked about, we were listening to the news, and I would tell him the stories about all these police shootings. And he was just baffled. He was always shocked at how these people were dying and why they were dying. And it seemed like their deaths weren't justified. So I guess I wanted to just say, share that, a person from, that was a police officer in the middle of a war zone, their police etiquette was different. They have real risks there. They have suicide bombers that they have to look out for and assess. But even there, they weren't as trigger happy. They were careful to pull out their guns and point. So I just wanted to make a comment about that, how big of a difference that is, the irony of it. And so that was just my comment.
Salen, thanks so much for those thoughts. And Cammie, is there something of a culture here that where this type of violence seems to happen fairly frequently?
Yes, there is. There is a cultural aspect to it, and what your caller shared is very striking. But when we think back about police culture, I think of it as kind of characterized by three things. We have group loyalty, right? Police officers, they need to be loyal to one another because they're going to be in situations where they need to protect each other. So there's this fierce group loyalty, which sometimes can have a perverse nature. If you see someone doing something wrong, another officer doing something wrong, you may be less likely to say something. There's also the idea that violence is necessary, or that some level of aggression is necessary to promote public safety. And I don't believe that that's true. The two promoting public safety and partnering with promoting public safety and having police accountability are not mutually exclusive. But the third characteristic of police culture in the United States is the kind of a lack of supervision and training. We know that in many cases there have been cases where officers have exhibited a pattern, individual officers have exhibited a pattern of behavior, but they've been, allowed to stay on the police force or promoted or even left there to train other officers. And so we do need to look at police culture, a lot of which, and what I described, I think that a lot of that folks recognize that was the culture, and there have been many attempts to change it, but we're not quite there yet. We haven't waded through all of those issues to really come to an appropriate policy solution.
Thanks so much for that call, Zaland. And Cammie, as we start wrapping up here, I'm struck by the fact that in both of these cases, in Seattle, where the victim called the police herself to report a crime, and in Minnesota, where Philando Castile told the police officers, "I have a gun, it's a legal gun," they did what was right. They did what they were told was the correct thing to do, and yet both of them ended up dead. And so how do police officers and law enforcement agencies build those relationships, especially with minority communities?
Right. And this is very important. What I was saying earlier about promoting public safety and keeping police accountable, we can do both, that they're not mutually exclusive. We don't have to resort always to violence and death of people that we're trying to, that we should be trying to protect and serve. And so it's very damaging, though, to the community relationships. And I think that there are a lot, and I do want to say that I believe that the vast majority of police officers are professionals and are doing a difficult job the best way they can, often without adequate training or adequate training, screening, all of those things. So that's another side of this equation that we need to think about in terms of officer morale.
And we'll have to leave it there, Cammie. Thanks so much for joining us today. Cammie Chavis is a professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University School of Law.